Blog Talk Radio.
State of Arizona versus Jody Ann Arias, verdict, count one. We the jury, duly impaneled and sworn, in the above entitled action, upon our oath, do find the defendant as to count one, first degree murder, guilty.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I done said the right thing, but it must have used the wrong line. I've been on the right trail, but it must have
Good evening.
Wrong.
This is Clear and Convincing with Michael Carnahan and Lisa O'Brien, where we explore the most infamous cases in our country's history, based not on the court of public opinion, but from the perspective of the courts.
I've been running, trying to get hung up in my mind.
This time, the court will read the verdicts. On count one, the verdict reads as follows. We, the jury, find the defendant, Stephen A. Avery, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide as charged in the first count of the information.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been a wrong song. I've been in the right place.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us for Clear and Convincing, the show that looks at criminal cases from the perspective of the courts, not the court of public opinion. We're Lisa O'Brien, podcasting from New Orleans, Louisiana, and Michael Carnahan from Little Rock, Arkansas. Tonight is episode 8, State of California versus Kevin Cooper. We're joined by Jason Anderson, 36th District Attorney of San Bernardino County. Mr. Anderson has been a member of the California State Bar since 1997 and served as a Deputy District Attorney for San Bernardino County from 1998 to 2014. He entered private practice in 2014 and has been an adjunct professor of law teaching criminal procedure and trial advocacy classes at the University of Laverne College of Law. He is a 2008 recipient of the Jennifer Brooks Lawyer of the Year Award from the Western San Bernardino County Bar Association, a 2012 recipient of the Above and Beyond Award from the National Crime Survivors Organization, and a 2018 recipient of the George W. Porter Criminal Trial Attorney Award from the San Bernardino County Bar Association. We'll talk about the case against Kevin Cooper and debunk some of the claims made in his third request for clemency and his request for an innocence investigation, which are currently before California's Governor Gavin Newsom. We are a live show, and as always, calls are welcome. Our phone number is 347-989-1171. And good evening, Mr. Anderson and Michael. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Lisa.
Good, Lisa. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us and taking the time to talk to us about this case. First off, though, I want to say something that's very important, and I neglected to tell people at work today, and my uncle's angry at me. May the 4th be with all of you. He's a big Star Wars fan. So if you could start off, Mr. Anderson, telling us a little bit more about yourself than my bio, which I...
I appreciate that. It was very kind. You covered it very well. I've been in the criminal justice system now for going on 23 years. The majority of it as a prosecutor, 5 years of it actually as a defense attorney. I've been the elected DA here in San Bernardino County for the last 2 years. Two and a half years. So I have a pretty unique perspective when it comes to looking at issues in regards to cases, appellate cases. I also understand what it means to represent defendants charged with very serious crimes. I tried 5 murder cases as a defense attorney when I was in private practice. And so it gives me a pretty unique perspective than just being a career prosecutor sometimes in looking at these issues, and particularly when you're dealing with continued claims in cases in which people profess their innocence in the defenses that are given. Oftentimes it seems novel to the public to hear these things, but in reality, so many of the things that are built in defenses in any case are argued in most cases. And it's very similar in the Kevin Cooper case. But I've been fortunate to be in this system, particularly in San Bernardino County, for that amount of time. And so I've enjoyed it. As you indicated, I've been a professor for over 18 years at the law school, teaching criminal procedure and issues like that. So it gives me a pretty good perspective on this. I didn't know a whole lot about the Kevin Cooper case when I came in as the DA, and I've done my own research over the last couple of years, obviously as a result of the legal machinations of Mr. Cooper and his team and considerations by the governor.
Right. And I think it's another thing that's important for our listeners to understand is that you represent not only the people of San Bernardino County, but you represent the Ryan and Chris Hughes families.
Yes. Yeah.
It's your duty to see that they get justice.
Well, no question about it. And they still have, there are still relatives. The Hughes, obviously the parents of Christopher Hughes are still alive. Still very active in our community. They're wonderful people, and they always have been and they always will be, and not because of this case. Obviously, they've experienced a horrible tragedy, but they are just pillars of the community and always have been. And you're right. I mean, the California Constitution requires there to be a voice for the victims, and we continue to be that. And they're very gracious in understanding the wranglings that have gone on in this case, and they're very gracious in allowing us to argue the facts on their behalf. So you're right, Lisa, that is part of what I do.
Correct. And if you had any doubt about Kevin Cooper's claims or his guilt as the district attorney, you would also have a duty in that case to, but in this particular instance, there is no room for doubt.
You're right about that.
You're not just defending it to say, don't, to prevent saying we made a mistake.
That's correct, and I have an ethical obligation to make sure that the right thing is done, not just that a conviction is defended. And I can tell you, Lisa, I've had an opportunity in my career one time as a prosecutor where DNA results came back once on a case, and we had to instantly dismiss it because it instantly created reasonable doubt. And that was a difficult thing to do. The victims were scratching their heads wondering what was up, but I can tell you it was one of the more rewarding experiences I've had as a DA, to know that you no longer had somebody in custody who you couldn't prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is not one of those cases. If you independently look at the record as I have, it is not one of those cases.
Correct. And I guess to kind of touch on the evidence that was presented against Kevin Cooper at or rather the evidence that he left behind in connection with his crime. Could you give us just a summary of that?
Yes. He had actually escaped from a prison that was located within 5 miles of where the Ryans resided. And actually it was probably closer than that. Just about 126 yards of their house with a guest house on the property that was vacant. And that was the house that Cooper hid in as he was trying to figure out how to get out of the area because he knew it was going to be discovered that he had escaped from prison. So there was significant physical evidence and even his admission at trial that he was in that house. What happened was that after he called two ex-girlfriends who were not willing to help him, he went over to the Ryan home after they had returned home and they were asleep. And discovered that they were in there. And so he killed all of them except for Josh Ryan. And then he took their car, and the car was found the next morning in a parking lot at a church in Long Beach. He eventually fled to Mexico. There was physical evidence in the house linking him to the house. There was his blood inside of the Ryan home, inside of the station wagon were his hairs and also cigarette butts that contained his DNA. There was a hatchet that was part of the murder weapon that was used that was discarded on the road on the way out from the Ryans, and it contained the blood and hair of several of the victims. And then near that, the route leading from the house to try to get to Mexico was a T-shirt, a tan T-shirt that eventually was discovered contained the blood of Mr. Doug Ryan, the father, and it also had Kevin Cooper's blood on it, And the blood on the T-shirt matched his blood that was found inside of the house. And there were a number of items that he was seen with, weapons that were taken out of the hideout house, the house that was 126 yards away from the Ryan home, that were identified by people who owned the home and had previously stayed in that. And so you had a number of evidence there. There was also, I think one of the things that often is not talked about enough is the fact that Mr. Cooper took the stand in his trial, and he perjured himself when he indicated that he never masturbated in the hideout house, when in fact there was a blanket that was found in the room where he slept, actually in the closet where he slept, that contained his semen. That was, to me, that's powerful evidence, because it gave the jury the ability to discard some or everything that he talked about, and they discarded all of it in relation to all the other evidence that was found.
Right. And there's also, if I understand it correctly, there was some evidence from Jessica and Doug Ryan in the Lease house that prosecutors believed at the time that Cooper went back to that house, cleaned up, and then left.
Yes, there was they checked the sink traps in the bathroom in the room where he stayed after he escaped from the prison. And they found some old matted hair that looked like it had been in there a long time. And then they found some newer hair that had looked like it had just been deposited. And it matched, the hair matched visually Doug Ryan's hair and Jessica Ryan's hair. And there were also plant burrs that were found in the house in between the hideout house and the Ryan house. There were plant burrs that were matches to plant burrs that were on Jessica's nightgown that had been pulled up. After she had been killed, there were post-mortem injuries that were inflicted on her with an ice pick. There was an ice pick or two missing from the hideout house, and there were plant burrs on her her little nightgown that matched plant burrs that were found in the house.
And similar burrs in the car.
Yes. Yeah.
So, again, we're having more than just – there's more than just one thing that connects Kevin Cooper. There's multiple – a constellation of things that connect all these three scenes together. What led to Cooper's arrest?
You also have to remember, Lisa, too, that there were bloody footprints in the sheets in the Ryan master bedroom where most of the murders occurred. And there was a bloody shoe print on a spa cover outside of the bedroom slider. And that area was closest to the hideout house. And what was significant about that is there was a particular shoe pattern that was unique to Pro-Ked Do tennis shoes that were issued to prisoners at CIM. And there was a witness that indicated he specifically recalled giving those types of shoes to Mr. Cooper in Mr. Cooper's size. So it was between a 9 and it was a size 9, and that's what he wore.
Right. So, and then Mexico didn't work out for Cooper for whatever reason, and he talked his way onto a boat headed back to California. What led to his arrest, and when did that occur?
The arrest occurred about 6 or 7 weeks after the murders. And what led up to the arrest is he did go down to Mexico. He talked himself onto a boat to be a boat hand. He used an alias. And then there was going to be sea travel to some area, but because of the weather, they headed north towards Santa Barbara. The people whose boat he was on decided to meet up with some other folks. And apparently there was alleged incident where he may have sexually assaulted another female from another boat, and that she made a report. And when she went to the police station, his wanted picture was already out as a result of being wanted on the Ryan murders. And she saw that and said, that's the guy who tried to sexually assault me. And they called the police. The police showed up. And then when he saw the police, he actually jumped off the boat into the water and tried to swim away. So the flight is interesting, because obviously it's rarely talked about, but that's in California, that's evidence of consciousness of guilt in terms of the flight. So you could argue, well, Was he fleeing because perhaps he hadn't sexually assaulted the lady in, on the boat, or was he fleeing because he knew all along that he was wanted for the committing the murders of the Ryans and Christopher Hughes, or was he wanted because he'd escaped from Pennsylvania for burglarizing and then raping another teenager at knife point? So in any event, he was fleeing, and that evidence was indicative of his consciousness of guilt of one or of many things.
Correct. And then while the clemency petition portrays many of these issues that we're about to talk about as new, they're actually facts that were known to his original defense attorneys and avenues that his defense attorneys pursued during pretrial and trial proceedings. And the first one I want to talk about is Diana Roper and those friggin' coveralls that were destroyed rather than being examined.
Yes. Yes, so go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, now I've read Diana Roper's original initial statement to Deputy Eckley. She wasn't sure the coveralls even belonged to Furrow. She wasn't sure how they got into her closet. And frankly, I don't think she was sure of a whole lot at that point, except that perhaps she needed some attention.
Well, I think the thing that's most indicative about judging the credibility of Diana Roper is that she was never called to the witness stand by the defense. And I want to be clear, the defense never has any burden in a criminal case. As we all know, the prosecution has the proof beyond a reasonable doubt as to every element. So I don't want in any way intimate that, that somehow the defense had a burden there. But the defense also can call logical witnesses if they believe that there may be a basis for reasonable doubt. And certainly post-trial, they've argued about these coveralls, but they never called Diana Roper to the stand. So I think that what it indicates, Lisa, is kind of what you're talking about there, is that it just she's just not a good witness. There's just no reliability there. And let me say, too, that the characterization of these things, and I heard it before I was familiar with the case, was that these quote-unquote bloody coveralls, well, nobody knows what was on the coveralls, right? They weren't tested.
Mm-hmm.
But the defense at the time did know about the fact that there was a report about them, and they were given those reports at an appropriate time.
Correct. And they brought to the jury's attention the fact that they were taken in and destroyed without being examined because homicide did not follow up.
Correct. And it's good that they did, because that clearly could create doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, you, as a defense attorney, you're always going to, part of your defense in any investigation is going to be to say that the cops blew it. They were shoddy. They messed up. They didn't follow protocol. They rushed to judgment. These are things that I argued in the defense bar all the time, and that was the appropriate way to go. But it's nothing new. Those items were litigated, and the defense knew the status of those coveralls all along. They chose to do what they wanted to do. Subsequent different arguments certainly do not equate to an innocence investigation or showing reasonable doubt whatsoever.
Correct. And, you know, even the description Diana Roper gave, I think they tried two different stories and mesh them together, but they don't, when you look at the facts, they don't mesh. The coveralls don't meet the description of the coveralls allegedly described by the Canyon Corral bar patrons, because that's another recurring, it's like a constant rerun.
Correct.
It's like we're getting
correct.
A 1980s show over and over again, because that was something, again, known to the defense. Canyon Corral patrons testified at trial about these three clean-cut young men who don't match the description of Lee Furrow or any of his compadres in 1983, which is something I had never seen before, but it was pointed out in one of your response letters.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole thing with Mr. Furrow is he, that was known at one of the earliest possible stages, and the defense knew about that. And you know, he had an alibi, and that was confirmed. And so, you know, that plus the fact that, you know, again, the fact that Diana Roper was never called would indicate that the defense probably figured out she had so much of a motive or bias to make up stories, because Furrow went to a concert where people confirmed he was with another woman that she knew. And so, you know, you put all that into context, along with the fact that it is inconsistent with the others that may have been in the Corral bar, as you said, Lisa. And you have to remember this, from an evidentiary standpoint and looking at it in full context, the lack of physical evidence of anyone else being in that home, the Ryan home, other than the murder victims and Josh Ryan, the attempted murder victim, and Kevin Cooper, how could you have three people in there that don't leave a speck of physical evidence behind, and yet they're just cavalier enough to walk into a bar and sally up to the bar and get a beer with blood on their clothes where they just murdered four people and tried to murder a fifth? I mean, come on. You know, we still got to keep this in the realm of what's reasonable. That's not.
Correct. And that has always been the most difficult, and that they would pick the least house to get their weapons.
Yeah, just right after Kevin Cooper left. Right after, it just magically, right after Kevin Cooper left. Right at, I mean, you know, his stuff is still in the house there, you know, evidence of him being there, and they were lucky enough to walk into that house within minutes of after him leaving on foot, supposedly, and pick up the murder weapons and go over there. So, yeah, but when you put it in context like that, you do see how preposterous it is.
Right. And claiming there was a rush to judgment, I mean, he wasn't arrested for almost 7 weeks. And his identity, as far as forensically, was established even before he was arrested without the benefit of any blood samples or any evidence from him. Because A41, the drop of blood on the wall, excluded the Ryans. And the serological testing of the day identified the potential donor of that blood as African-American.
Right.
And that was all done before Cooper's blood was even taken in July of 1983. And that's another important, you know, an important part that the defense leaves out when they talk about 841.
They it's never discussed, and the three things that you will never hear even discussed directly, whether it's Cooper, his defense team, opinion writers, 48 hours, any of them, as far as I've seen, is they never discuss Cooper's testimony at trial in which he perjured himself. That's a critical thing. They never even talk about it. And number two is A41, is how do you plant somebody's blood when you don't have their blood?
Correct. And a lot of the pretrial testing of A41, Cooper's own expert was a participant and thus oversaw the testing.
Well,
and was a quality control almost.
No question about it. At every stage, in fact, that the defense at the trial stage rightfully requested essentially what we call a blood split in order to do their own testing. And that's the appropriate thing to do, and it was abided by. What's more critical, though, Lisa, is throughout every stage of the post-DNA testing, there's not a shred of doubt that it's Kevin Cooper's blood, and it's not mixed with anyone else's blood. And there's nothing else in there to indicate that it was tampered with. And so when you have beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's Cooper's blood in a house that he claims he was never in, and then the argument is, well, it must have been planted. The question is, how was it obtained in order to be planted when the logs show that it was collected at 12:25 in the morning on June the 6th?
Correct.
As far as the authorities know, they were looking for a guy named David Troutman. They were looking for a guy named David Troutman, maybe, or they were looking for three Mexican guys, or they were looking for three white guys at the Corral Bar. These were all statements they were getting. And so how is it that you even have somebody's blood to plant in a house? That question cannot be answered. And it's sort of what turned me when I looked at this case in terms of, okay, let's go back to the basics. And it just, the defense can't answer it. All they do is say, well, it must have been planted, without any explanation of how that possibly could have been done. And the third piece is the tan T-shirt. That's what they never answer either, because the tan T-shirt wasn't even introduced at trial by the prosecution. It was introduced by the defense.
Right. There was an interesting, as an aside, there's an interesting theory that's got so many twists and turns that you get dizzy. Someone, I think Gregonis is the target, planted the blood, thinking serology would do it, but then for some reason it didn't happen. And so he just went on his merry, because I don't understand why anybody would plant blood in a crime lab situation and not immediately test that spot and say, aha, the defendant's blood.
Yeah.
I don't understand, if you're planting, why you would plant something so small that, you know, by the time of DNA testing in 2002, it was dust, which is what A41 was, a very, very small. You know, if I'm going to plant blood, I'm going to plant buckets of it.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly that argument to be made if you carry it through, to think that they would be as nefarious to plant stuff. And again, the claim is the Cooper's blood was planted on the tan T-shirt too. So you've got two claims of planting that would have happened at separate times, that would have been removed some 15 years removed from each other, and then had the foresight for law enforcement to be able to do so in such a perfect way as to two separate instances of planting blood to match in such a critical area. And the reason that the tan T-shirt was introduced by the defense is that it only showed Doug Ryan's blood at the time. Subsequent testing revealed it's also Kevin Cooper's blood on there along with Doug Ryan. But I can see why the defense introduced it at the original trial, is that you've got a T-shirt with the victim's blood and you don't have any presence of the charged defendant's blood. That could raise reasonable doubt. I see that. And that's why the prosecution, at the time, the testing was limited, and that's why the prosecution chose not to introduce the T-shirt. And so, you know, it turned out that piece of evidence was one of the most damning, in my opinion, almost more damning than the A41, because of the presence of the victim and the defendant on one piece of item.
Correct. And then, of course, the cigarette butts that were found in the station wagon. There was one manufactured and one home rolled. And those, no doubt, it's Kevin Cooper's DNA.
There's no doubt about that. And then there's also no doubt about the fact that the Roll-Rite prison tobacco was found in the station wagon was consistent with the Roll-Rite that was found in the house. And it was what Cooper admitted to smoking in terms of that. But yes, over time, the post DNA shows that the cigarette butts contained his DNA. And even his own expert at the first round of post DNA said the two most relevant pieces of evidence are A41 and the cigarette butts. And even that expert tested them both and said they both contain Cooper's DNA. And again, so how do you plant unknown DNA on a cigarette butt? Where do you get that DNA from to plant it on a cigarette butt? And why would you choose a cigarette butt to plant evidence on?
Right. Well, so. I think the claim is that the cigarette butts that Cooper claims he smoked a lot, and that basically San Bernardino sheriffs collected cigarette butts from the Lee's house and then planted them in the Ryan car. But the Ryan car was found in Long Beach and searched before it was brought back to San Bernardino.
Well, and it was, yeah, so, and it was Correct. And the timing was with the cigarette butts in the car were found at a separate time in a separate location distinct from the house.
Mm-hmm. So, and some of their things are just downright insulting, like claiming that when it was revealed that the T-shirt was in the San Diego evidence, San Diego County evidence at the courthouse, then, of course, they said, oh, well, of course, San Diego County deputies are going to look the other way when San Bernardino comes wanting to do something nefarious. And that's, to me, that's downright insulting. But I think they're trying to create a situation where they can get yet another hearing and call everybody in to testify and try to make something of nothing.
The interesting thing in twofold, that's a great point, Lisa. So when I started looking at this case independently, the what I didn't understand about the tan T-shirt was the life of the tan T-shirt. I assumed that the tan T-shirt was introduced by the prosecution at the trial and was always maintained at the sheriff's department. I didn't realize it was introduced by the defense until I started reading the transcripts of the trial. And then I realized the reason it was in the San Diego Superior Court was that it was introduced by the defense, and so it was an exhibit by them that had to be maintained by the court until the court ordered otherwise. And mm-hmm. So what you then start to see is the absurdity of claiming that when his blood was found on it, to say, well, that was planted also, and there was this elaborate scheme between the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, the Superior Court of San Diego, the staff of the Superior Court of San Diego, to have the wherewithal to be able to plant blood on a shirt that the prosecution never introduced, and how would they have ever anticipated that the defense or a court would order that shirt to be retested 15 years after the trial? And mm-hmm. so when I think about the context of that, I pretty much at that point had gone, okay, we're just – this is – There's just no basis for that. I mean, I understand advocacy, but that's beyond the pale. As you say, it's offensive to you, but from a guy who's practiced for 20 some years, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. It is. And unfortunately, though, the times we're in now, basically law enforcement is damned if they do and damned if they don't, and they're all liars. And there are so many people that just believe that without any basis.
And the interesting thing in this case is that when you have a gentleman who has the prior criminal record, the fact that he'd escaped from 10 institutions before he got to California, and the fact that he used a number of aliases, in terms of credibility, it's interesting that credibility is never even, you know, mm-hmm. tested post-conviction. It's like if you even bring that up, you're like criticized. How dare you hold that against somebody? Well, you know, this is a credibility contest. And in areas in which you say Mr. Cooper doesn't have credibility, there's evidence to back it up. In areas in which you say cops have no credibility, you don't have any evidence to back it up. You have no evidence to suggest that 841 was planted. You certainly have no evidence to come close to suggesting that somehow the tan T-shirt was modified while it was sitting in the basement of a San Diego courthouse. But you know, that's kind of the what you're dealing with. We hope obviously that reasonable minds, particularly in what we think is in the office of the governor, is they will see through that also.
Correct. And then another thing go ahead.
I was just going to say, in terms of requests for clemency and innocence investigation, Cooper's had at least three innocence investigations. He had a trial, which is the ultimate innocence investigation in which the jury made a decision. He had post-DNA in 2002 in which everything was examined again, and it was actually worse in terms of the results because of the blood on the mm-hmm. tan T-shirt and the confirmation of the blood on A41 and that there was no tampering of any of the evidence. And the recent testing by Bodie in the last 2 years has excluded anybody else from being at that scene other than Kevin Cooper. And so this idea of innocence investigation, you scratch your head and go, okay, we've had three significant rounds of objective fact finders looking at something, and they've all determined the same thing. So at what point do you say the innocence investigations have already occurred, and unfortunately they've revealed that Mr. Cooper is anything but innocent? That's
right.
All we're trying to do. We're just trying to point out what we think is a very objective and reasonable approach on that, to get through all the noise of this idea that everybody in law enforcement is a bunch of liars, everybody's racist, and, you know, there was nothing better to do than to plant some scant evidence around a crime scene that involved the murder of four people and the attempted murder of a fifth. I mean, come on. If you put it in context like that, you just look at, you look at Lisa and probably like you are going, what are we talking about here?
Right. Exactly. And I think that's the other problem, too, is that until they get the result they want, the process is never going to be fair. And a lot of people believe if you don't get relief, then the whole process was rigged against you. And that's not how it is. That's one of the most important things I try to stress in talking about cases, is whether you get relief or not depends upon what you bring the court, what evidence supports your claims.
Correct.
And
correct.
Sometimes
it doesn't
go your way.
It doesn't. And the interesting thing, and that's a great point, Lisa, is that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to indicate the problem with the claims in Cooper's case. If you look at the entire case and the extraordinary review and due process that has been given for 35 years, it really takes away from the efficacy of cases in which people have been wrongfully convicted. There are cases that exist where people are wrongfully convicted. It's a shame. We never want it to happen. But claims like this, I think, really tear away at those legitimate claims and the legitimate efforts that attorneys make in instances that really erodes away sort of the public's idea of what the system is really about, which is what you just said.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. And then another important thing, I think they mentioned they wanted testing of hairs that were tested in 2004. Because they did get mitochondrial DNA testing as part of the review of the tampering claims. And essentially, contrary to their belief of what the mitochondrial DNA testing showed, it didn't show any outsiders in that house.
Correct.
Because it couldn't exclude Jessica, Peggy, and Josh.
Correct.
And then there were a lot of animal hairs.
Yeah.
That were also found. And I think one of the biggest things was that the allegedly pulled hairs were not pulled. And the clutched hairs were not clutched.
You're exactly right. Good for you to pick up on that. I thought the same thing. I when I first was aware of the case, when I saw clutch, I thought, okay, I want to see the clutch. That obviously sounds like you'd be grabbing in a defensive manner somebody who's attacking you. That was not the case. And it was never even described that way at the trial. And so for it to be characterized that way is deceitful, because it was never characterized that way at the trial, and that's the record.
Right, right. And from what I understand, the carpets had a lot of hair. There was a lot of blood. And unfortunately, the victims picked up hairs, I think in some cases, in the blood on their hands. Now, there's one thing that is an odd claim being made by Cooper's, by Norman Heil, and that is that Jessica got out of the house and went outside to a corral, I believe, and then was brought back into the house. Are you aware of any forensic report or opinion that Jessica got out of the house based on the burrs?
No. No, in fact, in terms of the account by the surviving victim, Josh, he heard the screams, got up, and it was shortly after he heard the first scream that he then identified his sister was already motionless right in the hallway that led into her parents' bedroom. And so mm-hmm. if you're talking about the series of events that would have happened really quickly, number one, there would have been no time. There's no physical evidence to indicate that any of the victims were outside of that room or just outside of that room. I would imagine that's a way to try to explain away the postmortem injuries that were inflicted with the ice pick and why the plant burrs would have been on her pajamas, because they would have been on Cooper as he had come across the field into the house, and then they were deposited on her and in the house. So there's got to be a way to get him out of the house, right? I mean, you can't get him out of the hideout house where all the murder weapons are. So you've got to figure out what's my best theory of getting him out of the house altogether. Well, you say the blood was planted, and then you say, well, the little girl must have gone outside or was taken outside. There's no evidence to indicate that. That was never a theory by the defense in any event at the trial.
Okay.
And it wouldn't have been, right?
And,
I mean, as a defense attorney, these claims that are made currently just have little to no credibility. And the defense attorney would have known, boy, if I'm trying to pitch some of this to a jury, I want them to at least buy into some of it. If I really
Correct.
Argue all of this stuff that's currently, the jury's going to be so far off the idea that they're going to just discount anything that I say. And so, again, it goes back to the competence of the trial attorney. He picked his battles. And mm-hmm. now it just seems as if, nothing's off base, right? It's just kind of crazy.
Yeah. It's I've heard it termed the shotgun defense and the spaghetti defense. Throw it at the wall and see if it sticks.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that somebody put it very poignantly to me that, imagine, if somebody said, I'm not going to rest until I prove the world is flat. And then that person just continued to repeat that the world's flat and these are the reasons why that you should believe the world's flat. Well, it would never end, I guess, right? If somebody said, okay, well, continue on and convince us, that the world's flat, I mean, the rest of us would go, well, okay, how long is this going to take? And maybe we'd put up with it because there wouldn't be as much at stake. Here you got the lives of people, the legacy of victims, and the truth of what every deciding decision maker has made in 35 years on this case is that the world isn't flat and Kevin Cooper is guilty.
Mm-hmm. Correct. If the world were flat, cats would have pushed everything off the edge by now.
Oh gosh. I've never heard that before, but I like it. That was that right there alone was worth, that was worth tuning in, Lisa, right there. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's I get a lot of my wisdom from memes on Facebook.
Good work.
So, and, very quickly, one of the other sources of Mr. Heil are the dissents issued by Judge McEwen, which really wasn't a dissent. She was concurring but not happy about AEDPA. And then
Correct.
Judge Fletcher's dissent in 2009.
Correct.
Now, in the real scheme of things, what impact would those dissents have in the courts if were to file another habeas claim, for example?
Well, the easy answer is this, is 2 times 0 is always going to be 0. Judges are free to disagree, but the way our court system works is it regards appellate review is the majority has the say. And here's the example I give people, and I remind them about how the dissent may be something that people think is interesting, but it doesn't carry the day. Supreme Court
Right.
dissent, there were dissenting opinions when Arizona versus Miranda was decided. There were justices that dissented and did not think that suspects in a custodial interrogation setting should be advised of their Miranda rights. But we have Miranda rights. There were dissenting judges when the constitutionality of same-sex marriage was voted on by the U.S. Supreme Court. And if the dissent had won out, then same-sex marriage wouldn't be legal in many states in this country. And I also remind people that there were dissenting opinions in the Obamacare decision. And so if the dissenting opinions had any weight, you wouldn't have universal health care. So you know, to say that the dissent in a criminal case is going to carry the day is to ignore precedent and to ignore, you know, what we see working out throughout the courts every day. And I don't mean to be flippant, but to me it's very offensive that there's reliance on dissent opinions when dissent opinions are discarded oftentimes by the parties who don't agree with them. But in the legal instance, 2 times 0 is always going to be 0.
Correct. And that's it's a great explanation as well. A lot of the criminal decisions, a lot of, you know, Curtis Flowers, I think the gentleman from Mississippi, if dissents carried, then he would still be in prison.
Right, exactly. And so there's got to be that respect for the process. To tout that, you know, Judge Fletcher talks about possibly an innocent man going to death row, he mischaracterizes the facts, and it doesn't matter. Even if he didn't, you were outnumbered, and that's the way it works, and he's been on the other side of that. I guarantee that those judges have written opinions in which others disagree with them, and in their instance, those judges carried the day with their reasoning and the facts and the law, and so it is meaningless. It's meaningless. And the problem is that's a teaser for the new generation to think, like you said earlier, Lisa, oh, there must be something to it.
Judge Fletcher did. Yeah, I mean, he did. He relied only on what benefited Cooper, and he ignored contrary testimony.
Agreed.
I mean,
you're right.
Willfully.
And I don't begrudge him.
Yeah. I would be concerned with him on the panel for the challenge of the dismissal of Governor Newsom's or the lethal injection challenge suit. Is that still pending?
Yes.
When I saw that he was on the panel, I thought, why didn't someone ask him to recuse? Because Kevin Cooper being involved.
I see that. I mean, we trust our jurists to you know, they take an oath and we assume they're going to follow it, right? We will see. Of course, it's not that hard to take a dissenting opinion when you're it's basically, you know, what, 9 against how many? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's when you know you're not even close to carrying the day, it's a little bit easier to be a champion of a particular position. You're not really out anything.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, in the 2009, actually they didn't have enough to vote to hear it en banc.
Right.
And that was what prompted Judge Fletcher and his cohorts to author this opinion, so the dissent. But that is, like I said, that's an interesting way to look at it. And it's not a factual, not really the factual authority that Norman Heil holds it out to be.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is if Judge Fletcher had been a juror and he would have believed some or everything that Cooper's attorney would have believed, then he may have voted differently. But the bottom line is he was not in that position to be a fact finder. And everybody who has been in a position to be a fact finder has decided about the guilt. And so I understand somebody perhaps disagreeing, but our process says, what do the decision makers think? And he wasn't a mm-hmm. decision maker in that particular instance because he was in the minority. Anybody in the minority in an appellate court is not a decision maker. They have an opportunity to sway and to review and ultimately garner enough votes, and he didn't do it. And that's why it's meaningless.
Right. Now, the Governor Brown and Governor Newsom each ordered additional DNA testing outside of California's 1405, I think it is.
Yes.
One of the things in the press dealing with this issue has been that they didn't develop DNA profiles from a lot of the evidence that they examined because of the time and degradation of the evidence. Was that Is that an accurate representation, or is it
well,
more of a spin?
In 83, the science wasn't nearly what it was, what we have now. Even in 2002, 2003, the science wasn't even close to what we have now. And so there's not been any degraded evidence. There was just an inability to be able to get results from certain scientific evidence back in 83 that they subsequently have gotten in the rounds of testing by Bode from what Governor Brown and Governor Newsom ordered.
Okay. All right. So, and so they the big headline should be that Lee Furrow has been excluded.
Yeah, they'll never say it. And you know, the other thing you have to remember is that the protocols in terms of handling of certain things were different, like the hatchet handle, the sheath, all that kind of stuff. You know, at the time of the testing, once testing was exhausted, it was thought that, well, that's the end of it. And, you know, that's the way it goes. But again, the testing that existed and the subsequent testing that has enhanced it, again, exclude anyone else from being present there other than Cooper and the victims. That's the bottom line.
Okay.
So.
Right. And then there was a partial profile on the towel that we don't know whether it is related to the Ryan home or the Lee's home or played any part in the murders.
It was collected, but it was never associated. Right.
Right. And there is a single male profile with no match to any reference samples.
Including Furrow's.
Including Furrow, and no match in CODIS.
Correct.
But there's also no reference samples from court personnel and 83 jurors, attorneys, personnel at the courthouse. So there's a potential that male profile may be unrelated to the homicides,
right,
and may just
for
be
sure
from handling of the towel in 1983. Especially
right,
the officer who collected it is no longer with us, and there's no
correct
reference sample from him. And I think that's another thing people don't realize and don't understand. DNA doesn't say this belongs to Lisa O'Brien.
Right.
She's 56 years old, and she was born on this date. DNA, you have to have a reference sample from someone to compare it to that profile and see if those two profiles could be from the same person.
Correct.
And absent that reference sample, the DNA is going to remain unknown.
Correct.
So, and I don't
and
think
you
people
also
really, they go ahead.
I was going to say, you also have to keep in mind that towel could have been deposited days or a week before the crime even occurred. That towel may not even be connected or relevant in any way with the hatchet, with the shirt, with the crime scene at all. So, I mean, think about your local streets, how much litter is out there.
Right. And picking up a cup and DNA testing it, it's
right,
not going to get you anywhere.
No. Even if you had a known sample on it, it doesn't mean it's connected to the crime scene.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's possible that orange towel was used by somebody in that neighborhood and discarded out of a truck. And subsequent to that, that person ended up in CODIS. And the towel comes back and hits on somebody who's in CODIS, and you identify a John Doe. And then you find out that John Doe had nothing to do with the crime. He had an alibi or whatever. I mean, it's these rabbit holes that you go down that you're right. That people hear that and they go, oh, that must be a glaring hole. That must be reasonable doubt. Well, there's a lot of things you have to establish before you can even make that orange towel even relevant, regardless of what the science on the towel is. That makes sense?
Yes. And it falls under more of the uncorroborated assertions, like You know, Cooper claims he braided his hair, and so on the night of June 4th, his hair was in braids. Well, there's no corroboration of that claim.
Yeah. And,
so
and
his hair
remember,
could have been the wild bush that Josh Ryan saw.
Yeah.
And then
Cooper's not known for his credibility, though. And again,
exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, let's put it in context. I mean, the guy mm-hmm. said he never masturbated. He testified to that at trial. He goes, he never masturbates. And he certainly didn't do
yeah.
it while he was in the hideout house, and his semen was found on the blanket. And so
right.
you don't believe him. And he'd escaped from 10 other prisons. So when he tells you that he did a certain thing with his hair, I don't believe it. He also testified that right before he left the lease house, he put his prison clothes back on to walk out into the public to try to get away from the area.
Uh-huh.
He put his prison clothes back on. Now, he had access to other clothes in that house. Why would you put your prison clothes back on when you just escaped from prison to walk around and try to hitchhike out of the area? I don't know if that's something that you were aware of.
No, I don't think I was aware of that.
I don't recall reading that. That's what he said. That's what he testified to. And that's incredulous. And so you have to look at that when you're talking about the lens of credibility in terms of the way his hair may have looked when he was in the house. Because remember, he would have had the benefit of knowing that Josh Ryan said he saw a puff of hair.
Mm-hmm.
So having the benefit of knowing that, certainly you may tailor your testimony to be, my hair was a different way.
And I think that's also part of the reason, and that's why some of their claims don't make sense, is because they're just trying to be contrary. And they're not
yep.
thinking it through to the logical. Because the Burrs, you don't have to put Jessica outside the house. You just say whoever came in the house brought the Burrs in.
Yeah.
So, and I think they kind of lose track of what's what. They're so busy focused on a few specific things that they're losing the big picture.
Too busy accusing everybody of misconduct.
Exactly. Pot, meat kettle. Yeah. That's yep. when, like I said, the San Bernardino DA was the one misrepresenting facts and omitting facts.
Yeah.
I yelled. My sister was like, "What is wrong with you?" But I did. I yelled an expletive because I couldn't believe that Norman Heil actually wrote that. So.
Well, and the difference is those claims have been litigated. Those claims were made at the trial level. Every piece of evidence was challenged in terms of its admissibility or raised as a result of discovery violations. So those
mm-hmm.
those things were resolved at trial level. And then there's been separate, not just review on appellate review, but actual testimony. Judge Huff, they called, 40-some witnesses to determine
yeah.
if, in fact, there was all this. I mean, so we're not talking about this thing that is captured in time back in 1983 and 84 and 85, and then it's just this dead record of transcripts. There was a subsequent full-on month or two-long hearing involving live witnesses, despite the physical evidence, live witnesses to determine if there was misconduct, and it's always been determined that there was not. So
mm-hmm.
there's a record that cuts
Correct.
Against the claims that are currently made. And that's what's frustrating is I know it can be seductive to a new audience now to think, oh, my goodness, all these claims. These are not new claims. They are not claims that haven't been reviewed. They've been thoroughly reviewed.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the only new thing is they do claim to have four new witnesses, one who claims to have seen the Ryan station wagon on June 5th. After it's already documented being in the church parking lot.
Correct.
But, and frankly, in 1983, when Michael and I talked about this back in July of 2018, 1983, station wagons were the SUVs.
Right.
All GMC station wagons looked alike. So the Buick and the Vista Cruiser, the Mercury, the Ford, they looked alike. And you were unusual if you didn't have a station wagon.
Yeah.
So,
that's a good point.
She could have seen, and, you know, I don't care if you saw five people or four people or two people. You could have seen a vehicle going about its business. Although there is a very interesting claim that she wrote down the license plate, that it had been published in the newspaper. I guess she didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about the to go back to these four witnesses that claim these things that then supposedly, I don't know why you would have witnesses that could be so convincing that you would not reveal the identity to anybody else to allow them to be examined. If I had convincing witnesses, I'd want everybody to know, and they've never been disclosed in terms of the identity. So there's an issue there. As it relates to the car, though, that it was really the it's amazing the coincidence, the incident of pure having somebody not having any idea what's going on, of confirming when they
dear.
Put that flyer, you know. So put the flyer under the window of the car.
Michael, did he drop?
I can hear you.
Shoot.
Lisa, I can hear you.
Oh, no. We were getting to the best part.
Lisa, can you hear us?
I can hear Michael.
I think Lisa,
Michael, can you hear me?
Has some issues. I can hear you.
Okay, so I'm still on.
Yeah, go ahead. Give me one second. She has a storm rolling through.
Oh, okay.
I apologize for the technical difficulties here.
Hey, can't do anything about nature.
Hey, that's certainly true. Give us one second here. I'm going to tell her to call back.
It's just like the scientific evidence in the Cooper case. Can't refute it.
Hey.
Can't stop a storm from rolling
one
through.
One of them is lost.
Okay, there we go. She hung up. She should be calling back here in just a second. But you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of these, it's crazy to me how a lot of these defense tactics that we go over each and every week here on the show, they all seem to mirror each other. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you're right. They blatantly just spit in the face of that.
Yeah. Well, there's not a single case that I did as a defense attorney where I didn't challenge the police's investigative techniques. I didn't challenge them on their motive, their rush to judgment, their bias against my client, testing on whatever science.
Testing whatever science.
So it's what you do. It's what you do.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I have a storm moving through, and my I lost my phone or my computer or something. So
I can hear you now.
Can you still hear us, Lisa?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I just went dead for a few minutes. And sorry, now I've picked up an echo.
I was just telling him, you know, the more you hear about these, we talk about these every single week. And like he said, you know, it's crazy how much that these defense attorneys just spit in the face of facts. You know, they're all alike in that a lot of defense attorneys just, like you mentioned earlier, spaghetti theory, they just start throwing stuff at the wall and facts be damned, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and again, I want to be careful in my position that I certainly don't hold anybody, I don't hold it against anybody that would advocate on behalf of their client. I did it.
Right.
Defense attorneys are expected. What you're saying, but the difference is, yes, you do have theories. And so there is a way of saying it's a shotgun approach or throwing spaghetti. But there's a receiver of that spaghetti. There's a wall that says it's going to stick or it doesn't stick. And in this instance, it was the trier of fact, and it's been the post-DNA testing, and it's been all the appellate courts that have operated as the wall and says, okay, in this instance, it doesn't stick. So I don't fault the attempt to get the spaghetti to stick. what I want to remind people of is there's been a process that is tested whether it will or not, and it will not. Over and over again, it does not stick in this instance, if that makes any sense.
Yes. And in this particular case, Kevin Cooper has had extraordinary due process because he's had at least three hearings, and in some cases he's presented new versions of old claims. And I think something lay people don't seem to understand is that it's not just Kevin Cooper going in and presenting his witnesses and then the court decides. The prosecution, the state, has its opportunity to present contrary witnesses, to test Cooper's witnesses and cross-examine them. And then the judge weighs and determines who's more credible and whether or not Cooper's evidence met the clear and convincing standard, and it didn't. And right before I lost my phone or whatever I lost, I was getting ready to go over some of the rehashed evidence. Of course, one of the biggest ones is Josh Ryan's initial statements while he was being treated in the hospital are not the be-all, end-all. He was a young child with severe head injuries. He gave an initial statement where he thought it was three individuals who had been there right before they went to the barbecue. And I think over time he realized that that wasn't what happened. And when he spoke about the murders, as I recall, to a therapist, he actually only referred to he. He never referred to they. And that was what led to the theory that they were looking at a single assailant.
Right.
Well, and then
Josh Ryan is that you have to realize about Josh Ryan's statement. There was a video statement that was introduced by the consent of the defense at the trial, but the defense was also allowed to test that credibility against what you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the jury understood that he may have given inconsistent statements. It wasn't as if the jury wasn't allowed to weigh what Josh Ryan initially said versus what he ultimately said. That happens in every case. The difference is the jury also had the scientific evidence and all of the other evidence that put Cooper in the house. So that's why, you know, I mean, so it wasn't as if this, again, this is not new. This is not a new revelation. This all existed at the time. The defense knew every bit of every statement that Josh Ryan said as it related to anything that happened in that house on that night that he may have seen.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've always admired about Mr. Kochus, I know I'm not pronouncing his name correctly.
Kochus.
The original prosecutor is he did not call Josh to testify at the trial because he didn't want Josh put into a position of believing that his testimony would decide the case, that it wasn't something that Josh needed to be put through. And I've always admired that. But there was a videotaped statement where the prosecution and the defense were able to question Josh, and the defense was able to thoroughly cross-examine him.
Yep.
Without limitation. So, but if you read some of the defense material, you would think that these things didn't happen.
Correct.
And then there's the controversy over the blue shirt that was seen by Laurel Epler somewhere in the vicinity of the Canyon Corral bar. The interesting thing, I don't know if you remember this, Mr. Anderson, Michael may not remember it. Does anybody remember the pictures of the dress that some people saw as white and gold and some people saw as blue and black.
Oh, I think so.
That is my explanation for the T-shirts, because only one T-shirt was collected. Only one T-shirt was reported.
Right.
And I think what happened is Laurel Epler thought what she saw was blue, and that's what she reported. But when Deputy Fields responded, and as I recall, she wasn't there when he collected the T-shirt.
Correct.
So, and I think that that's basically what happened. She thought she saw blue. He picked up what he picked up was actually tan. It's laying out in a field somewhere. That's another big controversy that has been thoroughly examined before Judge Huff.
Correct.
So,
and the defense at the trial was aware that there may have been a discrepancy between either the tan T-shirt, no blue shirt, or two shirts, and it was a determination that they made that, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't pursue. They relied on the tan T-shirt. So again, it's these are not issues of new evidence. This was all known,
and it's been known since 1983, 1984.
Yes.
Then of course we have the rehashing of the destroyed coveralls. Yes, they were never examined, and since they were never examined, we can't say what was on them. Deputy Eckley did not believe it was covered in blood. So, and he has testified.
Correct.
About the coveralls in 2004, I believe it was. Then there were the claims about the elevated EDTA on the tan T-shirt, which Cooper's expert, Dr. Ballard, did not find.
Correct.
And then another claim that has me scratching my head, they claim now, first they claim there were two blood types in BB2, which is a vial taken on July 30th. 1983 from Cooper. They seem to have abandoned that because I believe Bodie found only one profile,
correct,
DNA profile, and that was Kevin Cooper's.
Correct.
Now they're saying there were two vials and one is missing.
But I
think again they're playing fast and loose with the facts, because I think it's there was a vial and there was a reference card.
Correct.
Or a swatch.
Correct.
The swatch was consumed by Cooper's expert, Terry Melton.
Yeah.
And then I think on the 48 hours interview, Cooper's DNA attorney now says that they're troubled by the fact that there's very little blood left in BB2.
Well, I mean, it's been tested for 35 years, and the swatch was made out of it, you know. So, I mean, you know, I got news for you. You know, when you take a bite out of a sandwich, there's a little less of the sandwich than before. I mean, you know, I mean, come on, you know. So it's crazy. It's seductive, right? It's very seductive to talk about these things, but you know, our experiences in reality do not bear out these claims, and the science that he has asked for. He has asked for it, has refuted his claims every time. But again, I won't rest until I prove the world is flat. So, you know, that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. The vial, I mean, it could be, you know, 35 years that blood just doesn't hold up.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it's been
and
tested.
And then it's been tested. It's probably been used to prepare. Well, I don't remember. The swatch, I think, was sent to the DOJ.
Yes.
and then went on to Terry Melton, which she consumed. But, I mean, if she can consume that, it's going to be consumed in other testing. And then I think that pretty much, you know, I think that pretty much, I don't even want to go over these roads again. I'm tired
okay.
of these
no,
reruns.
You, yeah, you've covered them. I mean, you know, again, it's been covered. So the, you know, the critical thing I think for your listeners that is learning about this case for the first time is that these claims are not new. They've been thoroughly, thoroughly examined, and rightfully so. I want to be very clear, Lisa, rightfully so, right? And mm-hmm. I say that because the science is the science, and the science continues to indicate that Kevin Cooper is guilty. And just because you say something over and over and over again doesn't make it true. Tone doesn't equal truth. In this case, the evidence and the science does.
Right. And there is one, there are a couple of little things. There's one, their allegation now is the multiple victims and the use of multiple weapons prove it could not have been a single perpetrator. Based on Josh's statements, I disagree. Because what he describes is a blitz attack on Doug and Peggy and then the kids. That's what breaks my heart, is these children.
Yeah, it's
who were brutally attacked for no reason other than that they could have identified him.
Well, what I'll say about the testimony and the order of it is, again, you have a lack of physical evidence that anyone else was in the house other than the victims and Kevin Cooper. So that refutes that there were multiple attackers in that instance.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also remind people, because this is a claim that's been made, is that Richard Speck, Ted Bundy, and Jeffrey McDonald all killed multiple people, and they did it by themselves. So it's not unprecedented to have a single person be able to kill more than one person. And as you said, mm-hmm. Lisa, you discount the kids in this. You know, when you wake up and your parents are screaming and then you see your sister laying in the hallway or outside their bedroom not moving, I mean, there's no way to process what's going on
mm-hmm.
in terms of that. And so many of these injuries that were inflicted were inflicted post-mortem. I mean, it was hate. It was evil. It was the scope of the injuries that were inflicted didn't even need to be inflicted. These folks were incapacitated very quickly based upon the skull fractures, and yet they suffered so many different injuries after that. I mean, this was rage. So
right. I've long agreed with that. And
yeah.
I've wondered how he managed. Mm-hmm. One of the things when Michael and I first talked about the case, I was surprised that he didn't kill the woman that came into the Lease house the second day he was there. I was surprised that that didn't happen, because I think that's who Kevin Cooper is.
Well, I mean, he could have been out in the barn. He could have, you know, he could have been over in the, you know, in the Ryan house. They weren't there. Who knows? I mean, you know, there are a number of explanations. It could have just been, you know, fortunately for that lady, she was in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he wasn't even aware, but he could have been asleep. He may not even know
yeah.
she was in there. So.
And then the other allegation is that Cooper was an accomplished car thief and could have stolen the car without entering the house.
Yeah.
That one is another one that's like you're not thinking this through, because it's really not what you want to be saying when you're talking about a murder committed to steal a car.
Yeah. No, to say it could have happened a different way doesn't mean he's not responsible for what happened in that house.
Right.
You know, there was no way he would have known, you know, where the keys of that car would have been. What would have happened if he'd have started that car with family inside? Remember, this is a guy running away from a rape allegation in Pennsylvania. This is a guy who just broke out of a prison under a false name. And so you're dealing with desperation here and obviously rape as a result of the crime scene inside the house. So it's easy 38 years later to go, oh, well, let's just compartmentalize this as easy as we can. And, you know, in the minds of a very logical and reasonable thinker, you know, that wasn't what's happening here. So this is a guy that, you know, it's, you know, conniving and desperate for his own needs. And when the two ex-girlfriends wouldn't help, you know, there was another way in which he had to figure out how to get out of Dodge. So.
Right. And that was it. And, you know, just like as far as the burglaries and his history of burglaries, well, maybe after all the noise and screaming of the murders, he thought it was a good idea not to search the house for valuables and to get away from the house as quickly as possible.
Well, he failed. He did not kill the witness in Pennsylvania and ended up in prison as a result of it. And so the lesson that might have been learned is this time you don't leave any witnesses.
Yeah, right. But then the killing took so much, made so much noise, perhaps he was worried that somebody might have heard the noise.
Sure.
And so he didn't take the time to go through the house and look for valuables or look for money. Although I do think he stole a coin collection of Jessica's.
Perhaps, yeah.
Because, and that's the other interesting thing is that he, you know, the things that he admits to, and yet people don't believe he's capable of this.
No, I know. Yeah, that's not even worthy of discussion there. That's, you know, the difference is, luckily in the world of prosecution, motive isn't an element. And so we don't have to prove motive. Mm-hmm. It helps to explain. But in this instance, it wasn't an element, and it doesn't change the science.
Right.
So
that's another interesting thing. From a practical standpoint, how much of an impact does the lack of a conviction have on looking at a person as a perpetrator of the crime for which they've been convicted or other crimes? And in Cooper's case, he stipulated to the rape in Pennsylvania and his victim testified. So he can't really say now, well, I haven't been convicted, so you can't talk about it.
Yeah.
And then the victim of the incident in Santa Barbara testified.
Yeah.
So her allegations have been tested during the penalty phase. In reality, I mean, do you have to ignore something on a person's arrest record because they haven't been tried and convicted?
Well,
as
a
prosecutor,
at times it may be excluded, but in this instance, the record contains this. We're not making this up. These facts about Pennsylvania and Santa Barbara were things that were on the record that are reviewed on appeal in this case, and so you can't just conveniently discount them.
Right.
So. And again, on the larger scheme, what you often hear, particularly with some of the other things that I've reviewed in looking at this case in 2 years, is that Mr. Cooper has steadfastly maintained his innocence over the years. And whenever somebody says something about something else, we judge their credibility, and we have a prism with which to judge that credibility. Obviously, we're going to make as self-serving statements about ourselves as we possibly can. We all do that every day. We try to make ourselves look as good as we can in any light. But then you look to extrinsic things that would impact somebody's credibility. Escaping from prison institutions 10 times and being involved in serious and violent felonies like burglaries and rape affect your credibility. They do. I'm sorry. I know his team doesn't like to hear it, and I know his team will accuse everybody of misconduct who even brings it up. But that's the reality of what we all live every day. And it applies to Cooper as much as it does anybody else.
Correct. And, you know, they want to apply that to Sheriff Kidwell, Baird, Gregonis, furrow. You know, they want everybody else's business to be front and center, but then when it comes to Kevin Cooper, you know, behind that curtain, because that's all the bad stuff.
Right, and that's advocacy, and I get it, but that's a distraction from the science. That's a distraction from the science of the last 35 years and the people that have been in a position to review this case and be decision makers who continue to confirm that Cooper's guilty. All the personal attacks on everybody else are a distraction. That's all that they are. And it's not uncommon in the world of litigation, in the criminal realm. And fortunately, we have 35 years of a body of a record that stands up against that type of advocacy.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This has been a great conversation and a great perspective on the case.
Absolutely. It's been amazing.
Well, I want to thank you both for asking me to do it and for reaching out and in this forum. So I really appreciate it. And for, you know, you guys, you know, being prepared and giving me, you know, an opportunity to answer questions. And I just, you know, we appreciate it. And I do know that I think the Hughes would appreciate it, certainly. And so I hope I was able to contribute some.
Thank you. Yes,
absolutely.
You did a great job. And I wanted to say, I noticed on your website, you have, or your office has a podcast. Justice
yes.
Talks. When does it air?
We've done one of those, and our media our people, Mike and Grace, they've been very busy with other things, and so we haven't been able to get
okay.
around to another. But what I'll do, Lisa, is now that we have your contact info, when we
mm-hmm.
put another one together, I will let you know. So there's no set time that
Perfect.
It airs. It really is about resource when we have cases and we have individuals in the office who have the time and ability to talk about things, then we'll put it
mm-hmm.
together. But, you know, our work ebbs and flows. We're a big office with 570 people. So we have great intentions of keeping that consistent, but sometimes it takes us away. But we'll let you know when we launch the next one.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And if there's another case or ever anything you would like to come on and talk about again, please reach out and give us a call, because you're a
appreciate
great
that.
Guest. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, guys. You guys have a nice evening. Hope the weather doesn't get too crazy for you there, Lisa.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. All right, I'm going to sign off. Good night, guys.
Have
good
a
night.
Good one night.
Man, Lisa, I'm just saying, you get killer guests.
I just... You know, it never hurts to ask.
Yeah, that's true.
I reached out for a letter, and I said, by the way, if he ever wants to talk about all these recycled claims, give me a call.
Right.
He is a great, and I know it's difficult to get district attorneys sometimes because something they say can potentially be turned into new evidence
mm-hmm.
or a new claim. And so sometimes there's like a fine line. But he was great, and I have to say, he did not limit what we could talk about.
Right, absolutely. He was very open.
And as you saw, everything I brought up, I mean, there are things on the outline that I decided, you know, we've talked about and we've touched on them. We're not gonna rerun. So
right, exactly.
I censored, but he didn't censor anything.
Absolutely,
I really
absolutely.
Liked him.
He was very transparent.
So, but yeah, so this is a good interview, and it's nice to have his perspective on the
absolutely.
Process and the proceedings with Kevin Cooper's case.
Absolutely, and not only is it a good interview tonight, but it actually sets up tomorrow night for another great interview.
Yes, it does.
Look at that transition.
I know, good job.
So
we Luckily, we are going to finish a little on the early side tonight. I have more weather coming and just thought that discretion is the better part of valor.
Yeah, that was weird. Like, that's never happened to us where just your audio went out. That was, like, we heard you just fine. We heard you just fine. You just couldn't hear us.
No.
That's crazy.
It was just static.
Right, that's crazy.
And but I'm glad that Mr. Anderson's part was not affected. That was that was good, and he was in a good, and
right,
I thought,
right.
Oh God, if Blog Talk has dropped, I'm gonna scream.
Yeah, no.
So I was relieved
we
it was just me.
Trying to tell you, we were like, Lisa, we can hear you. We can hear you. And then we finally figured out that you couldn't hear us. So
and,
that's where we figured it out about the same time you did.
And I can't put, you know, like the Blog Talk or the live video on.
Right, right.
So,
because then we'll get feedback.
Yeah, and I can't even have it open. So
yeah.
All right. Well, let's end on a high note. That was really good. I am really happy
with
that.
Yeah, but when the weather gets too crappy for you, you need to get in there and charge your phone just in case.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't know if the power's going to go out, but it's just the wind and the lightning.
Right, absolutely.
All right. Thank you for listening to Clear and Convincing with Lisa O'Brien and Michael Carnahan. If you like our show and want to know more, you can find us on Facebook, go to our blog at clearandconvincingpodcast.wordpress.com, or follow me on Twitter at O'Brien L. Ann. Join us tomorrow evening, May 5th, 2021 at 8 o'clock p.m. for a bonus episode of Clear and Convincing. In episode 9, we interviewed New York Times bestselling author Caitlin Rother about her recently released book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case. Ms. Rother's book, released on April 27, 2021, strives to correct rumors, misinformation, and conflation of speculative details to uncover the truth about the events leading to the deaths of Rebecca Zahow and Max Shacknai, which are inextricably linked. We'll be back on our regular schedule on Tuesday, May 12, 2021 at 8 o'clock p.m. Central for episode 10, State of Texas versus Lester Bauer. Bauer was convicted of the October 8, 1983 murders of Bob Tate, Ronald Mays, Philip Good, and Jerry Mack Brown in an ultralight airplane hangar in Texas. Parts of that plane were later found in Bauer's garage. Bauer's 2015 execution was controversial, and we'll talk about the murders, Bauer's arrest, trial, and conviction, and the issues raised during post-conviction litigation, including his claim of actual innocence made in 2008. Until then, have a great week and stay safe. Good night.